This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Milwaukee votes to use handcuffs in schools, starting in kindergarten, and the southern U.S. sees a rise in infant mortality. Joining us today to talk about these stories and more, Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington. Welcome, everybody, and let's go to the Milwaukee School Board. So they voted last week to begin training their security staff to use flexible plastic handcuffs on kids as young as kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. They have been subject to some really, really serious violent assaults, sexual assault on a female teacher, a principal attacked who got a stress fracture in her neck after her head was slammed into a wall. These are obviously very, very harmful situations. But these handcuffs are also not without potential harm, nerve damage if they're tightened too tightly. You've got Virginia Tech. You've got the echo of Columbine. Laura, is this something which it's unfortunate, but its time has come, or is this just crazy?
I think your point that its time has come is really relevant here. I think we've become more and more in society over the years, more and more tolerant of these kinds of measures. You know, there was a time when putting medical detectors in schools was considered unthinkable. Now, if you're in an urban community, it's absolutely necessary. Metal detectors don't solve all the problems, obviously. That's why we see cases like like Virginia Tech and Columbine. But I think we also have to be careful not to overreact. We should point out that this measure was approved in Milwaukee, but it still has to stand the test of community hearings, and they're going to be looking for community feedback on this, and I suspect that's going to be very controversial as well. But if something like this is put into effect, it has to be done with some very careful training. It has to be so that we can avoid some of the kinds of issues that you raised in terms of child safety. But the bottom line is discipline has become a terrible, terrible problem in schools today. And it's because these kids are coming to school unprepared, both emotionally, physically, and in terms of their mental health. And the schools are expected to deal with every single problem. They can't just teach anymore. They have to babysit. They have to be security guards. They have to be law enforcement agents. And they have to respond in some ways.
Michael?
Well, you know, tearing a page out of the Russell Simmons book, maybe if we call handcuffs something different than handcuffs, maybe we can use them. This is not about handcuffs. This is not about plastic cuffs. It's not about steel handcuffs. This is, as Laura has rightly put it, a law enforcement issue, a law enforcement concern. And not only do you have the training of security guards now, in urban areas we have police, actual armed police officers in the schools. And they are supposed to be experts in terms of the use of handcuffs. And some of us have been put in handcuffs. And believe me, the police officers are not very expert at putting them on. They do hurt. And they do hurt the little fingers and little hands of children. But I don't think we should have handcuffs in kindergarten, but certainly when we talk about teenagers who are violent and acting out and disruptive in a physical, violent way, you can never say never. I mean, it's better than a straitjacket, I suppose.
Bob, I guess it strikes me here that if the incident was violent enough to provoke handcuffs, wouldn't there already be officers deployed who had handcuffs? Is this just sort of going to be like a casual thing where teachers walk around with the handcuffs on their belt and, you know, anytime anybody throws a spitball,
you're passing a note? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, you're passing a note. All right, I'll pass this right over to you.
You know, I think that the handcuffs come into play when, because that you're right, Farai. That's one of the things. When a student is already attacking a teacher, you're not going to bring them out, I imagine, just when a student is angry, because how is this small teacher going to get the handcuffs on the 6-foot eighth grader? Without the eighth grader willing, you're going to have to tackle that child. But, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily a big child doing it either. I'm sure we all remember a couple years ago that kindergartner in Florida who was wilding out in the classroom throwing things, the police came and got her and put her in handcuffs. It was a horrible image, and that's the type of ugliness that we probably will see plenty of. But one of the things about this disciplinary measure, one of the things that the Milwaukee School Board has really grappled with is the fact that they understand, even as they're considering this, that they do not have the funds anymore to really deal with disciplinary issues in the school. And so that's one of the things that the school board member who's so passionate about this, speaking out against it, is saying, hey, you know, we're going to do this, but we also have to come with the carrot too, not just the stick. We have to take care of our kids. We have to have the money for programs to take care of our kids in another way. And that's really what's lacking.
All right. Well, we'll definitely keep track of this and want to move on to a story that really has some potentially large implications. There's been new data that shows a rise in infant death rates among several southern U.S. states, especially Mississippi. Now, their rates jumped from just under 10 per thousand births in 2004 to over 11 in 2005. The national average is 6.9 per thousand. Now, these may sound like small numbers, but when you add up the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of population throughout the region, it is really significant. And infant deaths in Mississippi among blacks rose to 17 per thousand deaths in 2005 from just over 14 in 2004. Is this something that speaks to the overall safety net failing? Any thoughts on that, Laura?
Well, I think that, first of all, this is not just exclusive to the South. It may be more severe in the South, but this is a huge problem, especially in the African-American community across the nation. And it's not a new problem. Infant mortality has been a major issue in the healthcare industry since the mid-70s, when we first discovered that there was a huge disparity, which I think continues between black and white infant mortality. And we've known since the 70s what many of the reasons and the causes for it. It's about the lack of prenatal care. It's about low birth weight babies. It's about the health conditions and nutritional opportunities that these families are getting, and it's frankly about young women, young single women having children and not being educated and prepared to raise these children. When you read the stories about what's happening in the South now, there's time after time you hear about these young girls in their early 20s who are on their second and third child, and some of those children, the previous children, have died. So this is not a new problem. We've never been able to get a handle on it. The rates have gone up and down over time, and it's something that we just really haven't had the public will to solve.
These rates are going up, though, which means that they did go down for a while. Is this a turning point, Bob?
Well, I think, again, much like with in Milwaukee, that you've lost a lot of money for different things for Medicaid. Medicaid became more stringent. I remember I was in Mississippi back in 2004 when this came down, and I was traveling around the Delta with this doctor who goes house to house, makes house calls, and because the people can't get to it, can't get to the different clinics. But, you know, this happened 3 years ago, and as Laura said, this has been an issue since the 1970s and, of course, beyond, further than that. It was really frustrating reading this article and hearing about this because people just refuse to take any type of personal responsibility for themselves. The woman who's pregnant and comes to the door eating breakfast of the soda and the potato chips, even when services are offered, they're not going to do it. They're like, they'd rather just not. And did you see the pictures of these women? These are huge women. It's like, you know, honestly, being overweight causes so many issues in and of itself. No, they were not pregnant. They were just humongous.
Some of these women are 300, 400 pounds, Michael.
Exactly.
Obesity is a huge problem.
I'm not trying to defend anybody who's overweight. God knows. Because I have my own struggles with it. But, you know, one thing that happens a lot in this society is that it is actually easier to get the worst kinds of foods, whether it's, you know, something fried from the little shop around the corner or the soda or the potato chips, than it is if you don't have a car and you don't have a grocery store in your neighborhood to actually go get fresh fruits and vegetables.
But I'm saying you could just buy some cereal and milk. That can be bought at a corner store.
Well, you know, part of the problem is what bothers.
So you see this as a personal responsibility issue, Michael.
I see a lot of it as personal responsibility. Sorry, Michael.
Yeah, well, part of it, that was Bob. This is Michael. Part of it is personal responsibility because there are a lot of teen mothers who still think that they can drop babies the old-fashioned way, and they're just not thinking. You have to be concerned about your diet and your nutrition. You have to be concerned about your weight and not just the weight from the pregnancy. You have to be concerned about disease such as diabetes and whether or not you have hypertension. You have to be concerned about yourself because you're concerned about your baby. And, you know, healthcare delivery is very important. If the healthcare, if access to the healthcare delivery is restricted, you go out of your way. You got to make the extra mile. You got to take the extra step to get to see doctors. You got to have nutrition. You got to have diet. You got to have concern for your baby as well as yourself. So, you know, having babies, caring for babies, raising babies, it's an education issue. It's a healthcare issue. And it's also a lot of people are having children who are too young themselves. They don't know what it means to have a child. They don't know what it means to take care of themselves. How can I take care of another human being?
All right. On the personal response, go ahead, Laura.
Can I just come back to the whole obesity issue? I think we also have to be concerned that we have a real strong cultural bias in the African-American community about obesity and a real denial about it. We believe that big is beautiful. We believe that our food is good. Our soul food is so good.
We believe that
obesity and things like diabetes runs in the family. And I think that denial factor, I think, is universal and not just among young
poor women. I guess I'm not in the black community because I don't believe any of that. That's all nonsense. Yeah, and racial rhetoric.
All right. On that note, I want to reintroduce our sparky panel. We've got Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington, Bob Meadows of People Magazine, and this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. And moving on to humane execution. This is a really controversial topic. As you know, today and on Thursday, we're focusing on exonerations of innocent prisoners. Now, there's been a new study that was led by researchers at the University of Miami. It found that the cocktail of drugs that is used to execute death row inmates could be cruel. It could cause paralysis without rendering the prisoner unconscious, and the prisoner might be able to feel great pain without being able to cry out and show anything other than tears. Is this a situation where we have to revisit the very concept of a humane lethal execution if the drug combinations may not work that way? Bob?
I don't support the death penalty. And I just say that just to throw that out there. But if we have it and if we did, I imagine a lot of people would say, so what? These people didn't have any mercy on the people who they killed. So what if it hurts? Good.
Wow.
Is that what you think?
I imagine that's what people think. I don't support the death penalty.
But you don't support it.
It's an argument. I mean, look, death by hanging, death by firing squad, death by electric chair, death by suffocation, you do suffer. You feel that hanging. You know you're about to die. You do feel those bullets from a firing squad. You feel that electricity in an electric chair.
I think that the idea of lethal execution in some way was meant to be a humane advance.
But
over
it's not
those
an advance.
Methods.
But the study just said it's not an advance. My point is, and I think it's Bob's point is, if you believe in the death penalty, you believe in vengeance, and you don't care if it's you suffer during the course of that. That's vengeance. But if it is a question of an advancement, then it's not an advancement, and therefore, let's abolish the death penalty as a cruel and unusual punishment, period. I'm in favor of abolishing the death penalty, period. The United States Supreme Court is not in favor of it because we have a dunce of a Supreme Court. Not right wing, a dunce of a Supreme Court.
Laura, go ahead.
I think you have a kind of a biased panel here because we're all against the death penalty. My concern is there's no way to humanely execute another human being. That is why most of the world sees us as barbaric because we continue to practice this. I do see some hopeful signs, though, as you had in your conversation with Barry Scheck earlier. There is a lot of reform going on in the criminal justice system and a lot of ways in which we are trying to curb opportunities to kill people. And I think that if we can put some science behind this and get beyond the political debate, if we can put some science behind this issue of whether or not we can humanely execute people, whether it's lethal injection or electrocution or any other way, maybe we can work toward abolishing the death penalty entirely.
It's an oxymoron, Laura, and Texas is still
killing. That's why I think it's barbaric.
Texas is killing. This country, they got to wake up and smell the coffee. Mm-hmm. They got to wake up and decide, what is it about our humanity? What is it about our society? What is it about our death penalty that we have to make a decision about in terms of public policy.
Now, I think it's what you said before. It's about vengeance. I mean, it's plain and
right.
Simple. People
and
think
the
that they're
Supreme
going to get
Court,
even.
And the United States Supreme Court and the Congress and the United States Senate and the presidents who confirmed these people have put us years, decades behind in terms of social advancement and progress. So you got to change the court. You got to change the political tea leaves. You got to get people to vote the right way to get the dunces out of office.
All right. I have one last topic very briefly, everybody. Texas jury awards $9 million to a racial attack victim, Billy Ray Johnson, beaten and dumped in a field after he was lured to an all-white party where underage drinkers fed him alcohol and taunted him. He was found unconscious with a serious concussion and bleeding in the brain. Now, a jury of 11 whites and one African-American speedily returned a verdict on the civil case. In the criminal case, the men accused of assaulting him were fined and sentenced to probation and jail time, but they didn't get very much of a sentence. Is the civil court, as evidenced in a case like this, really where people go for recourse in racial justice issues?
Well, in the criminal case, they were not convicted on felony charges. So that's why their sentence was lighter than they would have gotten had they been convicted of a felony charge. They were youthful offenders. And another thing, you know, to be consistent, we have to have a rational policy about youthful offenders. Do we want to put youthful offenders away and lock them up from prison for 25 years or 35 years?
All right,
so
I'm
going
to have
this was a first-time offense.
Okay, Bob?
In the criminal way.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, the civil court is always where you can turn to, or not, perhaps not always, but I'm glad the jury awarded this man the money. I'm sorry that the gentleman who attacked him didn't face any time. They were all given probation. But I guess it's much like with the O.J. case. This is, where they turn for justice when you couldn't get the criminal decision.
This wasn't a killing.
All right, Laura.
Absolutely. The O.J. case is right on. This is an opportunity to use civil cases to rectify what criminal prosecutions have failed to rectify. It was a horrific crime, whether it was perpetrated by young people or older people. I was very encouraged by the fact that it was a predominantly white jury in a place like Texas, which is stereotypically supposed to be a hotbed of racism. I think these kinds of – you're going to be seeing more and more of these kinds of cases, and I think it was a good decision. I don't think they'll get any money out of it, but at least it's sending a message.
I'm
sending a message. No more time.
We'll talk about that later, Michael.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We have had Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist from WBEZ in the Windy City, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine. As always, spirited, and thank you.
Thank you.